Hi, everybody. It's Derek, and this is your Foreign Exchanges World News Roundup for Saturday, April 6th and Sunday, April 7th, 2024. Let's get into it. We've got a couple of anniversaries. On April 6th, 1250, this is the anniversary of the Battle of Faraskur, which ended the somewhat ill-fated, actually really ill-fated, Seventh Crusade. The crusade that was led by Louis the Ninth of France, the future Saint Louis, for his crusading enthusiasm. He wasn't very good at it, but he was very enthusiastic about it. He invaded at the head of an army for the Seventh Crusade, invaded Egypt. The thinking for the Crusaders at this point was you had to conquer Egypt to be able to successfully take and hold Jerusalem. And so he invaded Egypt, concocted this interesting plan that would have taken him down the Nile, across the Nile, to the city of Mansura. They were going to capture that city and then move on Cairo. The plan wound up falling apart. You can read about the Battle of Mansura at the website if you want. I don't even want to go into detail, but the plan fell apart. Louis wound up being chased back across the Nile, back north, and then surrounded by the, at this point, Ayyubid. It was still the Ayyubid dynasty ruling Egypt. It would soon be the Mamluks who took power. But at this point, technically still the Ayyubids, surrounded by them and was forced ultimately to surrender. He was taken hostage, had to be ransomed for a lot of money. It was really just basically a complete disaster, although not as big a disaster as the Eighth Crusade, which Louis also led. You can read about that on your own time. But Faraskur, again, there's a piece about this battle up at the website. It's also interesting if you're interested in Egyptian history, because this is the point at which the Mamluks seize power in the aftermath of this battle. So it's kind of a milestone in Egyptian history as well. Also on April 6th in 1896, the games of the first Olympiad, aka the first modern Olympics, opened in Athens. The ancient Olympic Games, believed to have begun in the early 8th century BCE, were discontinued either by Roman Emperor Theodosius I in the 390s or by Theodosius II in the 420s. French educator Pierre de Coubertin, who died in 1937, was the driving force behind their revival, which led to the creation of the International Olympic Committee in 1894 and the first modern games 2 years later. On April 7th, 529, the Codex Justinianus, the first section of Roman Emperor Justinian's Corpus Juris Civilis, was completed. The Corpus Juris Civilis was meant to standardize and codify imperial law, apologies for the bad Latin, which had fragmented into multiple codices and laws that didn't necessarily cohere with one another. So Justinian ordered a review and a modernization of these law codes upon his accession as emperor. The Codex is the product of that effort. It has influenced everything from canon law in the Catholic Church to the legal codes of the Ottoman Balkans and modern Greece to contemporary international law. On April 7th, 1994, one day after Rwandan President Juvenal Habyarimana and Burundian President Cyprien Entaryamira were assassinated when their aircraft was shot down before landing in Kigali, either by Hutu extremists or by the then rebel Tutsi Rwandan Patriotic Front militia, Hutu genocidaires began slaughtering Tutsi Rwandans en masse. The ensuing genocide left hundreds of thousands of dead, including Twa Rwandans and some Hutu, along with the Tutsi, with highest estimates putting the death toll at over 1 million. It finally ended in July, with the RPF seizing control of the country under current Rwandan President Paul Kagame. Moving on to the news, in the Middle East, we start in Israel-Palestine, where the Israeli military, IDF, pulled out of Khan Yunis on Sunday, which means that most of its forces have now been withdrawn from the Gaza Strip. Only one IDF unit is currently in the territory, occupying the Netzarim corridor that the IDF is using to divide northern and southern Gaza. Before anyone gets their hopes up, I don't think this withdrawal means an end to the Gaza operation is nigh, nor do I think it reflects a retreat, even though it does come a day after militants killed at least four Israeli commandos in Khan Yunis. Israeli officials characterized the withdrawal as a rest and refit maneuver ahead of the IDF's entry into the city of Rafah, which could come at any time after the Eid Eid al-Fitr holiday this week. There's also plenty of reason to think the IDF is redeploying its forces in preparation for an attack by Iran that, depending on the form it takes, could mark the start of the regional war that the Israeli government seems to crave. In the meantime, a new round of ceasefire talks is set to begin in Cairo, including delegations from both the Israelis and Hamas. In addition to demanding improvements in Gaza's humanitarian situation, the Biden administration is also reportedly putting increased pressure on the Israeli government to make a deal and maybe pushing the Egyptian and Qatari governments to apply similar pressure to Hamas. So the chances of a deal may be increasing, although that doesn't mean a deal will get done. Hamas issued a statement on Saturday declaring its refusal to, quote unquote, back down from its previous demands, which were and presumably still are unacceptable to the Israelis. One demand in particular, the return of displaced people to northern Gaza, has reportedly become a key sticking point, and it's apparently here where the Biden administration is leaning on Israeli leaders to be flexible. This is a political issue for Hamas, which wants slash needs to show some concern for civilian safety in response to criticism that its October 7th attack in southern Israel put those civilians squarely in the IDF's crosshairs. Speaking of Hamas and its political considerations, Akbar Shahid Ahmed at HuffPost has published an interview with two of the group's senior officials, Musa Abu Marzouk and Bassem Naim. It's a very interesting interview. We don't have the time or space to parse it here, and I'm not sure there's much value in that, given that they are both clearly pushing a narrative. But I would urge anyone interested in that narrative to click over and read the piece. The link, obviously, is in the text of the newsletter tonight. In Syria, a roadside bomb killed at least seven children in southern Syria's Daraa province on Saturday. Syrian state media blamed the incident on unspecified militant groups, the remnants of rebel factions that have surrendered but still bear enmity toward the government. But the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights is claiming that it was a pro-government militia that planted the device in some sort of unspecified assassination operation. It's also saying that the blast killed eight children. The observatory claimed on Sunday that a clash between two rival militant groups, one of them led by a former Islamic State member who, quote, now works for military intelligence, end quote, had left at least 17 people dead in the wake of the bombing. In Lebanon, the IDF carried out airstrikes in eastern Lebanon's Bekaa Valley on Sunday. In a rare acknowledgement of responsibility, Israeli officials said the attack targeted, quote, a military complex and three other terrorist infrastructure sites belonging to Hezbollah's air defense network, end quote. They further characterized the strikes as retaliation for the downing of an Israeli drone the previous day. In Asia and Pakistan, unspecified gunmen reportedly ambushed a police vehicle in northern Pakistan's Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province on Saturday, killing at least two police officers and wounding two other people. This operation was presumably carried out by the Pakistani Taliban, or TTP, or one of its various splinter groups. Also on Saturday, another police officer was killed in a roadside bombing in the same province, while Pakistani authorities say that an army unit killed at least eight TTP fighters in a clash on Friday night. Elsewhere, a motorcycle bomb killed at least two people and wounded five others in southwestern Pakistan's Balochistan province on Sunday. There's been no claim of responsibility in this attack either, but Baloch separatists have been fairly active of late, so that's one obvious theory. In Indonesia, police reported on Sunday that a joint police-military security unit killed two regional commanders of the rebel West Papua Liberation Army in a clash on Thursday in central Papua province. A number of rebel fighters were reportedly wounded in the incident but were apparently able to flee. In Japan, the Financial Times is reporting that the Biden administration wants to expand AUKUS, the U.S.-UK.-Australia alliance based in part around providing Australia with nuclear-powered submarines that is definitely in no way about arming for World War III with China, to include Japan. Defense ministers from the three principals are apparently going to announce on Monday that they intend to open up what they call Pillar 2 of the alliance, the part that doesn't deal specifically with submarines, to potential new members. According to the Financial Times, Pillar 2, quote, involves collaboration on technologies such as undersea capabilities and hypersonic weapons, end quote. This comes as Japanese Prime Minister Kishida Fumio is visiting Washington this week, with he and Joe Biden reportedly planning to unveil This is again from the Financial Times, the biggest upgrade to their security alliance since they signed a mutual defense treaty in 1960. That is another quote. It's all part of a broader project to turn Japan's self-defense forces into more of a full-fledged military that can assume a larger role in the U.S.-led, not at all about China, Indo-Pacific order, which includes arrangements like AUKUS. The upgrade would likely put the U.S. forces Japan Military Command on similar footing with its U.S. forces Korea counterpart. Moving on to Africa and Senegal, new Senegalese Prime Minister Ousmane Sonko unveiled his new cabinet on Friday, calling it a breakaway government that embodies the project, a systematic transformation voted for by the Senegalese people, end quote. Sonko and his protege slash boss, President Bassirou Diomaye Faye, are promising a breakaway from Senegal's political past and apparently named a number of relative newcomers to key ministerial posts. It remains to be seen whether they can follow through on their promise or even coexist in their current arrangement. As Alex Thurston pointed out in his most recent FX column, which he has updated in the wake of the election, the recent history of these sorts of political partnerships in West Africa has not been particularly good. In the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Kodeko militants attacked a village in the eastern DRC's Ituri province on Saturday, killing at least 25 civilians at last count. Kodeko, an association of ethnic Lendu militias, is one of the most violent of the many armed groups in the eastern Congo. A United Nations report issued last month apparently said that it and the Allied Democratic Forces group, quote, are responsible for most civilian killings, end quote, in that region. Moving on to Europe and Ukraine, where the Ukrainian military launched a drone strike on the Russian-occupied Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant on Sunday for reasons that defy explanation. At least three drones struck the plant, including one that hit uncomfortably close to one of its six reactors. International Atomic Energy Agency Director Rafael Grossi took to Twitter to condemn the attack, saying that such strikes, quote, significantly increase the risk of a major nuclear accident, end quote. There doesn't appear to have been any substantial damage this time around, though Russian officials say that three people were wounded on site. On Saturday, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky sounded the alarm again about his country's dwindling supply of anti-aircraft ammunition. How or when he might expect to get resupplied is anybody's guess, particularly with the U.S. House of Representatives still flailing about over the approval of additional support. Even with renewed foreign support, the Russian military can presumably continue to exhaust Ukrainian air defenses with ongoing drone and missile strikes. All it takes is for a few projectiles to make it on target to cause damage, as with Russian missiles that killed at least eight people in Kharkiv on Saturday. In Slovakia, voters there elected former Prime Minister Peter Pellegrini as their new president on Saturday with a bit over 53% support. Pellegrini's election is a gift to current Prime Minister Robert Fica, whose Smer party is presently in a coalition with Pellegrini's Hlas party. Fica and current president Zuzana Chaputova do not see eye to eye, but Fica and Pellegrini should generally be on the same page. Slovakian presidents don't have a tremendous amount of power, but they can be an obstacle to an unfriendly government. In the Americas, in Ecuador, the Mexican government has severed diplomatic relations with the government of Ecuador after Ecuadorian authorities raided the Mexican embassy in Quito late Friday to arrest former Ecuadorian Vice President Jorge Glass. Earlier in the day, the Mexican government had granted Glass's request for asylum. He'd holed up in the embassy in late December, fleeing corruption charges that he has insisted are politically motivated. Regular readers may note that the Mexican and Ecuadorian governments already weren't getting along, with the latter having expelled the Mexican ambassador on Thursday over unflattering comments that Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador made about last year's Ecuadorian presidential election. That hostility aside, attacking the embassy of another country violates what is as close to inviolable a diplomatic principle as there is. Several days ago, we saw the Israeli military strike an Iranian consular building in Damascus, so this is becoming something of a trend. But attacking a diplomatic outpost in a third country is one thing. What the Ecuadorian government did on Friday, attacking a foreign embassy on its own soil, breached the 1961 Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations, which bars host country security forces from entering embassy grounds without permission of the ambassador. It's unsurprising that the raid sparked an outpouring of condemnation from around the world, and in particular from other countries in Latin America. And in the United States, finally, the New York Times reported late last month, this is while I was on vacation, actually, that that Israeli authorities have created a mass facial recognition program in Gaza that draws in part on Google Photos. This appears to violate Google Photos rules, but The Intercept's Sam Biddle reports that the company doesn't seem all that interested in talking about it. Let me read you a bit of his piece. The mass surveillance of Palestinian faces resulting from Israel's efforts to identify Hamas members has caught up thousands of Gaza residents since the October 7th attack. Many of those arrested or imprisoned, often with little or no evidence, later said they had been brutally interrogated or tortured. In its facial recognition story, the Times pointed to Palestinian poet Mossab Abu Toha, whose arrest and beating at the hands of the Israeli military began with its use of facial recognition. Abu Toha, later released without being charged with any crime, told the paper that Israeli soldiers told him that his facial recognition-enabled arrest had been a, quote-unquote, mistake. Putting aside questions of accuracy, facial recognition systems are notoriously less accurate on non-white faces. The use of Google Photos' machine learning-powered analysis features to place civilians under military scrutiny or worse is at odds with the company's clearly stated rules. Under the header, quote, dangerous and illegal activities, Google warns that Google Photos cannot be used, quote, to promote activities, goods, services, or information that cause serious and immediate harm to people, end quote. Asked how a prohibition against using Google Photos to harm people was compatible with the Israeli military's use of Google Photos to create a hit list, company spokesperson Joshua Cruz declined to answer, stating only that, quote, Google Photos is a free product which is widely available to the public that helps you organize photos by grouping similar faces so you can label people to easily find old photos. It does not provide identities for unknown people in photographs, end quote. Cruz did not respond to repeated subsequent attempts to clarify Google's position. I don't mean to laugh because it's awful, but what can you even say to that? That is just remarkable stuff from the company there, and good for Google. On that note, that's all for us tonight. Thanks to all of you for reading and or listening to the newsletter, and especially to those of you who are Foreign Exchange's subscribers making this newsletter possible. Until next time, take care, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.